the first Indiana gubernatorial debate of 2020. Candidates for governor announced their education picks, plus Governor Holcomb gets defensive on COVID, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 23rd, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb defended his job performance in the first of two gubernatorial debates this year, while challengers Woody Myers, the Democrat, and Libertarian Donald Rainwater assailed Holcomb's record, but from sharply different angles. Myers made news right off the bat. He announced he would appoint current state superintendent, Republican Jennifer McCormick, as Indiana's first Secretary of Education.
Dr. McCormick has done a terrific job. She knows that we can do better in education in Indiana, and she'll be one of the first people that I'll sit down with to make this state better.
The next governor will appoint the school's chief for the first time after lawmakers removed it as a publicly elected position. The debate was a rapid-fire series of questions on a variety of topics, from COVID-19 and education to guns, taxes, and the environment. Holcomb stood by his record.
We created momentum in job creation and all-time high wages through the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, capital investment. We made sure infant mortality rates were finally going down and adoptions were going up.
Libertarian Rainwater pledged to dramatically reduce the size and scope of government. Did Woody Myers get the job done? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, I would argue Woody Myers had the most to gain from the debate. Did he capitalize on his opportunity?
I don't think he did. It was a pretty vanilla performance, and he needed a big one, but to be honest, I mean, he shouldn't feel bad about it because the hill he's got to climb is so steep. He's so far behind, and in whatever poll you read, he's 20 or 30 points behind. I don't think the race is going to wind up being that wide of a margin, but he's clearly very far behind. And, you know, love the Indiana Debate Commission, but, you know, the gubernatorial debate isn't a place where you're going to go make up that kind of deficit. I mean, and the issues that he's picking and his approach to COVID is out of step with what Hoosiers want to see, where they want a continued reopening of the country, or of the state and country. Talked a lot about climate change and environmental issues. I think he'd be like a really good candidate for like the Bloomington City Council, but I'm not sure running for governor was in the cards for him. And I don't think most Democrats agree, which is why they never supported him, which is why this campaign has just flailed from the beginning.
Did Woody Myers need to do a better job than he did?
No, I thought he did an excellent job. And the juxtaposition of the positions on COVID could not be more clear. I mean, Woody Myers is not talking about shutting the state down. What he's talking about doing is what the governor promised to do, and that is to follow the science. We're at record highs, record hospitalizations, deaths occurring, and the governor either is not following the science, which he promised to do, or he lied to us when he told us he would back up when the numbers went the wrong way, one or the other. What's interesting about this, too, is how defensive Governor Holcomb was. I mean, you had a question from a senior citizen about property taxes. And, you know, you're on a fixed income of, what, $1,000, maybe $1,500 a month, and you get a property tax bill for a couple of $1,000s. That's a big deal, okay? And instead of talking about some ideas to deal with it at all, no. This is what you get with 16 years of one-party rule. He basically said, we fixed property taxes. You ought to be happy about it.
I think Ann's the Libertarian and getting rid of property taxes.
That was remarkably similar to what Donald
Rainwater
talked
about. Getting rid of them, but there are ways you can address senior citizens' problems with them, and they have none of those ideas.
We talked about last week whether these were too late in the calendar to make much of an impact, and maybe on this particular year's race because of the gap, maybe it won't. But if you were someone who didn't know a lot about these candidates, you learned a lot. This week.
Oh, yeah, you totally did. They covered a vast amount of issues, and, you know, you could hear them really say their piece, I guess, and they had a little button they could push if they wanted to rebut, and it was, you know, very polite, but also very informative for voters. So I hope a lot of them watched. I really hope they watch again this coming Monday. I know
Tuesday.
Yeah. I know.
Don't watch this coming Monday. You won't see it.
Tuesday. We've had like almost 500,000 Hoosiers vote already, but hopefully some more will still watch.
I talked to a political scientist today about the impact of the gubernatorial debates, and one thing she applauded the debate commission for was the fact that the Libertarian was on the stage. And she said that's a really valuable thing to have. Is that particularly true this year?
I don't know if it's particularly true this year. It's something that the Indiana Debate Commission deserves credit for. And it's not just this year. It goes back. That's part of the founding principle, if you will, of the Indiana Debate Commission. I know I've moderated debates where we had, you know, some people from one of the major parties would sort of roll their eyes and say, why are we wasting our time? But I think the principle at work here is an important one, which is anybody who's going to be on the ballot has an opportunity to convey his or her opinions and views to the people who are going to be going to the polls. And that's an important thing, and I'm glad that they do it. Now, whether it's more important this year versus any other year, I don't know about that.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, the last time we'll ask this before Election Day, who will win Indiana's race for governor? Eric Holcomb, Woody Myers, or Donald Rainwater? Last week, we asked you if you think the state is currently doing everything it should to address COVID-19. Just 16% of you say yes, 84% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, after Woody Myers announced who he would choose for Secretary of Education in the debate, Libertarian candidate Donald Rainwater announced his choice this week as well, Dawn Wooten. Wooten is a university English professor in Fort Wayne. She previously ran for state superintendent against Jennifer McCormick in 2016 at the Republican State Convention. Wooten says she would focus on getting rid of Common Core curriculum and standardized tests, and she criticized McCormick for her contentious relationship with state lawmakers.
And that is where things get done. So I think that another 4 years of her in the administration would not be good for our children or our teachers.
Democratic candidate Dr. Woody Myers said that if he wins the governor's race, he will keep McCormick as school's chief. But Rainwater hopes to make Wooten Indiana's first and only appointed education secretary. Both he and Wooten say they want to see the education secretary elected by voters in the future. Governor Holcomb has said he will review possible appointees after the election. And Delaney, between Rainwater and Myers, we now have two of the three people who ran for state superintendent of public instruction in 2016. So will Governor Holcomb be announcing Glenda Ritz as his pick soon?
I don't think so, because Glenda Ritz, like Jennifer McCormick, support traditional public education, and the governor doesn't.
They're both
Democrats. That's pretty obvious that he doesn't, because the increases that are going, other than the marginal inflation-related increases in public education, are going to vouchers and charter schools. And I think both Glenda Ritz and Jennifer McCormick realize that Indiana has dropped the ball in terms of funding public education. We're barely back to where we were in 2008 in terms of funding. And the governor's one-time approach of putting $1,000, okay, you know, that's better than a sharp stick in the eye, but it doesn't solve the problem. And now his commission isn't even going to report. And all the Republicans want to do after 16 years is cut taxes and do less. They don't see any problems out there. They don't see a need to have any bold ideas or to do anything that would move this state forward, which is why Mitch Daniels was correct. Every 16 years, a new broom has to sweep clean.
A bold idea would, I suppose, be appointing Glenda Ritz if you're Eric Holcomb, but I don't think that will happen. What should Eric Holcomb be looking for? And why? I mean, is there a benefit to telling us who it is before Election Day?
I think it limits you. One, it makes it political if you do it before Election Day. This was not for Raintree, but certainly for Dr. Rainwater. But certainly for Dr. Myers, this is kind of the last political gimmick of Jennifer McCormick's strange political career. And I think it makes it political if you introduce somebody with 10 days to go in an election. It also probably limits the amount of candidates who might be willing to have a serious conversation after the election about what the next Department of Education ought to look like. I think it's important operationally to have a superintendent or an educator who's going to create this agency. So I think that's pretty important too, not just from an education policy standpoint, and how is and teacher pay and school funding and all the other things they've got to pick off. But operationally, what does it look like, and what kind of resources are you putting into it?
Is announcing Jennifer McCormick and then Donald Rainwater announcing Dawn Wooten, is that purely political?
I don't know if it's purely political. You could make the argument that voters, it's an important position. It constitutes more than 50% of the state's budget, education, K-12 education I'm talking about. So it makes sense, I suppose, the argument goes to put forth one's ideas about how to staff that position, especially since now it's shifting from an elective position to a secretarial, to a position that's appointed for the first time. I don't think would have made sense necessarily for Eric Holcomb as the front runner to do it, because look at the math. Let's say there are 20 people out there who may be in the running to get the job, or at least in their own heads, or in the running to get the job. And so he announces it now. Guess what? If it's 20, 19 are disappointed and frustrated and said, that should have been me, one is happy. Now you still have 20 people saying, hey, I think this could be my job. Let's make sure that we get the incumbent across the finish line, so that he can then appoint me. I mean, it just makes sense from the political calculation. It seems to me makes sense.
20 votes may make all the difference.
Now,
hey, in some races, you never know. Probably not governor, though. Does this put any pressure on Holcomb to announce a choice, or even start to indicate who that choice might be?
I mean, maybe a tad. And to be honest, I interviewed Donald Rainwater a couple weeks ago, and he said he wasn't going to announce a Secretary of Education pick. So apparently things can change. I know that Governor Holcomb has had people come to him already and express interest, and they're doing a little bit of vetting. He said they would announce definitely earlier rather than later in November if he is reelected.
Right. Well, Governor Holcomb insisted this week there is still no need to reimpose statewide COVID restrictions. The average number of new cases has more than doubled since Holcomb moved Indiana to Stage 5 4 weeks ago and withdrew almost all restrictions. At his weekly press briefing on Wednesday, the governor said the state is in a much better place than early in the pandemic. He says hospital systems aren't overwhelmed and the state's PPE supplies are sufficient.
We know a lot more about this. We know how to fight back. We know we can control what we can control. And that has to do with distancing. That has to do with masking up. That has to do with good hygiene.
Asked multiple times about whether he would reimpose restrictions, Holcomb became defensive. He framed the choice as between staying in Stage 5 or going back to the harshest restrictions imposed during the early days of the pandemic.
And the last thing I want to do or need to do is go back to a stay-at-home. By the way, when we did, we didn't shut the state down.
Holcomb faced sharp criticism in Tuesday night's debate for his COVID response. Libertarian Donald Rainwater blamed him for ruining the economy. Democrat Dr. Woody Myers said he should reimpose some restrictions, like capacity limits at bars and restaurants. Nikki Kelly, have we seen this kind of response? One of them was in particular to your question. Have we seen this kind of response from him before?
He was not a fan of my question. No, that's definitely the most defensive I've seen him. Last week we got kind of like this lecture. This week we got, just a straight on, defensive position. I can see why he is, because he did for months and months and months say, we're following the data. And now most of that data is, actually, all of the data is going the wrong way. And now he, is just like, we have hospital beds, which we do, but very few compared to what it was 2 months ago. I mean, we're almost at the top of hospitalizations we've had the entire time. And, they took some actions to work on the long-term care cases, the nursing homes, that could help some of the hospitalizations. But as far as statewide restrictions of any kind, it has become very clear that he is not going there.
Part of the governor's argument is that, like Nikki just said, one is that we have hospital beds, and also that hospitals are better equipped to treat it than they were early in the pandemic. They know better how to treat it, and we also have way more PPE as a state supply than we did. But when you look at these numbers, 2,800 in a single day yesterday, 2,500 today on Friday, is the average person asking the same questions that these reporters are asking Governor Holcomb?
Well, he's to a certain extent backed himself into a corner now, because there's so much attention on his decision making and his departure, seeming departure from what he had specified as his criteria earlier in the process, that now if he were to reimpose certain restrictions, it would be perhaps portrayed as caving in or that he's sensitive to the issue or defensive, and that Woody Myers has gotten under his skin or is making a good point. The smarter thing to do, perhaps, would have been to follow the data from the outset. It wouldn't have become the big issue. You know, is he just doing this to, in awe of the White House and for fear of angering Mike Pence and Donald Trump, or is there something else at play here? It's kind of become an unnecessary issue, it seems to me, that if he had just followed the data, you know, he could have always pointed that. That would have given him political cover with Washington, it seems to me. And by not doing that when he did, he sort of now he's in a tough spot. He can't really go back on it now.
It seemed like he was following the data for a really long time before more recently these numbers have gone the other direction and we've stayed exactly where we are. But, Mike, he talks about, well, we're better prepared than we were earlier in the pandemic. But since he announced that we were going to stage five 4 weeks ago, and I calculated this yesterday and didn't update it today, but the average number of cases that the state reports was up 139%. How can you look at that and all of the other numbers? I'm just picking out one, but all of them are trending in the wrong direction. How can you, as the governor, look at that and go, we're fine where we are?
Well, I don't think he's doing that because you don't just look at that one set of numbers. You know, I think the available ICU beds statewide, I think, was 36% today. I think the number of ventilators available was almost 80%. So if you think back 6 months, the goal, we were preaching flatten the curve because it wasn't about people not getting sick. It was about everyone not getting sick at once. And the threshold, as I said before, was are people dying who shouldn't because they had access to the care they need, but the system was overloaded and they couldn't get it. That was the standard 6 months ago. Now that's evolved over 6 months to we've got to wait for a vaccine. In other parts of the country, certainly, in more liberal parts of the country. I mean, California may never reopen until everybody's vaccinated. You know, so I think one, he's clearly sitting in strictly political politics because we're 10 days out from an election. He's sitting between Rainwater, who wants zero restrictions and no mask requirement at all, or yeah, suggestion or whatever, and Woody Myers, who wants to dial it back to stage three and shut down. And he's sitting between that, while there is still capacity in the healthcare system. That may change, but we do know more. We're doing more contact tracing. We have better treatments, and things aren't what they were 6 months ago.
I want to ask about the...
No, they're worse.
I want to ask about the political side of this, because I hear this a lot from people like on Twitter and people who email me who say, oh, the governor's, you know, worried about the election. If you're Eric Holcomb, I mean, I'm sure you think or hope that Woody Myers will win. But everything that we look at tells us it's unlikely that that's going to happen.
It isn't just about winning the election. It's about irritating...
And I'm not suggesting that. But what, I mean, is that even a calculation in Eric Holcomb's mind?
I think the calculation in Eric Holcomb's mind, and you saw it on the front page of The Star this morning with Mike Pence up there, ready to embrace each other. No masks, no social distancing. He does not want to irritate his mentor, Mike Pence. And he doesn't want to bring the wrath of Donald Trump down on him in Indiana. That's what this is all about. And he is willing to risk the health of Hoosiers in order to avoid that kind of confrontation with Mike Pence and Donald Trump. Because their approach is the same as his now. Just let it go. Let it go. Groups of 250, 300, hey, no problem. No problem. Schools, you don't know what you're supposed to do. You don't know what the standards are. You don't have the resources to make the kids safe. No problem. Handle it at the local level. He has abdicated any thought of leading the state out of this pandemic. And he has done it in fear of Donald Trump and Mike Pence. And that is inexcusable. It's a total lack of leadership.
Why would Eric Holcomb, seriously, would Eric Holcomb be afraid of Donald Trump or Mike Pence?
There's world where Donald Trump starts assailing Eric Holcomb if he has a mask mandate
otherwise.
In place. Or if he goes back to 75% capacity in a restaurant or whatever. Whatever he would dial back to, there's no scenario where Donald Trump starts shooting at Eric Holcomb.
Okay, then why doesn't he do what's good for
people
of
Because I don't think he believes it's necessary, and I think I think he's trying to operate one end. We're sitting in downtown Indianapolis. Drive 20 miles in any direction, walk in a restaurant, and tell me how many people are wearing masks. There are parts of the state that do not care and think this is bull.
That's why you put a mask mandate in
place.
That
they won't follow.
And you put teeth behind it. If 10 people in the state
this
of Indiana
is, you live
are
in Indiana,
fine for not
Ann.
Wearing masks, the attitude will change.
We take joy in giving the government the finger in this state. This is a conservative
ten
state
people,
that you cannot tell what to do like that.
Fine. The whole attitude changes. Sorry.
You live in fantasy land.
Some students.
Yeah, that's where Mike Pence and Donald Trump are.
Some students
land.
In Indiana may have lost the equivalent of more than 1 year of learning during the pandemic's first months when school buildings closed. From WFYI's education desk, Eric Weddle reports on one of the first studies looking at the pandemic's impact on student academics.
Stanford University's Center for Research on Education Outcomes based its study on multiple years of student test scores for all traditional public and charter schools in Indiana, plus 18 other states. Researchers also factored in metrics about each school, such as family income and special education enrollment. They did this because there's no current test data available. The study estimates a range of learning loss for students. On average, Indiana students lost an estimated 209 days in math. That's more than one entire school year. For reading skills, students may have lost 130 days on average. That's about three-fourths of a school year. In response to the study, the Indiana Department of Education says it's working with local schools to overcome inequity and reduce learning loss for all students.
John Schwanis, this is certainly not an Indiana-only problem. But how should schools and the state and the country adjust to it?
Well, first of all, I'm glad somebody did this study, although I could have saved everybody money last week. I think I mentioned this very thing just from the gut, as the president likes to say. Clearly, this is going to be was a lost year. I think the standardized test scores will bear that out in Indiana and elsewhere. The only saving grace, frankly, for Indiana, and I mean you hate to look at it in these terms because kids are suffering and their educations are suffering, is that everybody's in the same boat. The people who are going to be vying for college admission in X number of years are in the same boat. The people who are going to be vying for those well-paying jobs in a certain number of years, they're in the same boat. So, I mean, if this were an Indiana problem, then we should start raising the panic flag. The fact that this is effectively a universal problem, again, I'm not saying it's great that kids are losing a year. It's a mitigator. It's not as much of a tragedy as it would have been, but it's still a tragedy.
The problem is, I think, going to come not now or next year, but 4 years from now, when presumably we want to start inputting these accountability measures again, and these kids are still behind. So are we going to have to rethink for a lot longer than during the pandemic only, how we're judging student performance?
Yeah, they're going to have to focus more on growth instead of just pass-fail. I do want to point out one thing that John mentioned is, you know, everyone's in the same boat, but that's not exactly true because some entities didn't go back in person at all. Some of them went half. Some of these urban or rural districts that don't have iPads to send home with every kid, you know, and there's four kids fighting over the one computer they have in their house. So it isn't all exactly the same, and I do think we will see a little bit of that.
And even with that, even in you know, you can have students who they go back in person, and then they have to quarantine. They're out for 2 weeks. They're back in.
Yeah.
They're out for another 2 weeks.
Or the teacher's out for
another 2 weeks. This is a huge problem to grapple with.
I think we need to think outside the box. I think it's, you know, at least the possibility of year-round schooling ought to be entertained, at least for a couple of years while we catch up. I mean, pay the teachers more, certainly. Put vacations for spring and fall and Christmas and whatever. But have the kids in school all year round until we make up this lost ground. You know, otherwise, we're taking a real risk with their future.
Is something like an out-of-the-box solution going to have to be what it takes?
Yeah, like given the last exchange, this is going to sound weird, but actually I totally agree with Ann. We may actually go to – we're clearly going to have to take account of this period of time and get creative on how we're skilling kids up and getting them up to where they need to be.
You talk about – I want to – one last thing to you, John. You talk about everybody across the country is in the same boat, and notwithstanding Nikki's points, generally speaking, that's true. But is the disparity going to come when in 2 or 3 years states are doing radically different things to try and catch up? Is that where we're going to run into a problem?
That's a good point. I hadn't really thought about it, but you're right. There will be states that maybe are more willing to think outside the box, that are more willing or more able to invest in the kind of mitigation that is necessary. Because think about it, while year-round school is probably a great idea, the cost, we're already, you know, have these incredible fights in the legislature at debate during the budget process over funding. When you throw in another, well, do the math. I must have had COVID in that math class back in my day. But whatever the math is, what, a third again more. So.
Well, and so we've talked a lot about this idea that some people want Indiana to stop messing with the school rules, if you will, for a while. Do we almost have to do that at least for a year or two just to stabilize things?
Pretty much. But we should at least still test the kids, though, and we should make those public. I'm not saying we should, you know, ding anyone for it, but we need to see in data how much we've gone down so that we can put money into maybe remediation in the next budget to help pull them up.
Where the politics are going to get interesting is rural kids are going to have the same problem as urban kids, to the point you said. The resources aren't there, the connectivity isn't there, and you're going to see the same
problems.
So
you're going to have rural Republicans in the same boat as
urban
Democrats.
Urban areas, Republicans and rural
areas. They haven't bulked yet. I mean, they charter schools and vouchers they've supported, and there are no charter schools in the rural areas and no vouchers to be used.
Well, we'll see if this changes things down the road.
It could.
That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, wear a mask, please, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.